Hello and welcome to episode 80 of Foreign Correspondence, a podcast that brings you interviews with journalists around the world. I'm Jake Spring, a foreign correspondent with 12 years experience in Brazil and China. This episode somehow marks 5 years of doing the podcast. I published the first episode in May 2019 when I basically had no idea what I was doing. I recorded episodes with three of my friends using a pretty unstable online recorder that I would not recommend anyone ever use, much less someone living in Brasilia with a spotty internet connection. I edited it on GarageBand, also not something I would recommend anyone try to do a podcast on. Those first three episodes probably took me like 15 to 20 hours each to produce. I really have no idea how I managed to publish an episode every 2 weeks, now when I struggle to put it out even monthly. I hesitate to go back and re-listen to the quality of those episodes, but I know the interviews themselves were good and still remember a lot of what we talked about. The format has changed a little bit, but surprisingly not that much. The podcast has kind of always been what I wanted it to be, so there wasn't much reason to change anything other than the occasional question. Needless to say, I'm glad I stopped asking every guest's opinion about Glenn Greenwald. There were some funny early moments. I briefly considered interviewing my guest's spouses, just for a short segment at the beginning or the end of the podcast, and even interviewed one of them at one point. Thank you to Don Weiland's wife, Shireen, for being game for that. I quickly realized that was not a particularly well-conceived concept, but I guess there were no bad ideas at that point. Anyway, we've come a long way. Thanks for coming along with me. Throughout all this time, I have thought about quitting, but what stops me is the guests. I just can't quit before I have certain people on the show. I tend to put them in three categories. One is the people I kind of know but want to know more about, and the podcast gives me an excuse to ask them those prying biographical questions. These are mostly people I went to college with but was not particularly close with. Most of those people have been on my list of potential guests since 5 years ago, and I've tried to parcel them out so I don't run through too many at once. This episode's guests, and a couple more I have on the way, definitely fit in that category. The second category is my white whales, the big gits that I would like for the podcast. At some point I thought I had three, but at this point I struggle to remember who they were. I remember there was Brian Phillips, the former writer for Grantland, who is just a beautiful writer, and I'm a huge fanboy of him. Then there is actually Glenn Greenwald, who is needless to say a larger-than-life character with an amazing life story, and who happens to live in Brazil like me. And there are also people like war reporter Anthony Lloyd, and maybe Howard French, although I tend to have a rule that my guests must be actively working as journalists, with that being their main livelihood. Anyway, the fact that I haven't even tried reaching out to these people means I subconsciously may not be eager to end the podcast. The third and final category is myself. Doing 80 of these interviews, needless to say, I've had time to think about what my answers would be. But give it another year or two and we'll get around to me. That brings us to our guest for this episode. Sean Collins Walsh is a political reporter who covers City Hall for the Philadelphia Inquirer. I went to college with Sean and have been meaning to invite him on the show for years. He is admittedly about as far from a foreign correspondent as you can be. He is reporting on Philadelphia where he grew up. That, if anything, makes it more interesting. I know plenty of people who move to cover far-off places, but people like Sean are actually a rarity among journalists, I think. He is also maybe one of my only guests who has worked at a tabloid newspaper. There aren't a lot of tabloids in the U.S. It's always been more of a British thing. Sean's stories of working under the legendary editor Gar Joseph at the Philadelphia Daily News are really a highlight of the episode. And yeah, it does make me wish I'd worked at a tabloid. Sean's also done a 5-year stint in Texas and has always managed to stay one step ahead of journalism layoffs with a timely exit to go to the Philadelphia Inquirer. Most recently in March, he was on a team of 5 reporters at the Inquirer who won the Toner Prize for Excellence in Political Reporting for their coverage of a quite crazy election for Philadelphia mayor last year. We'll talk about that election also. So now, without further ado, here's my interview with Sean Collins Walsh, a City Hall reporter for the Philadelphia Inquirer. Thanks so much for coming on the podcast, Sean.
Thanks for having me. This is great.
To warm up a little bit, if you could just set the scene for us, could you describe where you are, both the physical space around you and geographically, and then also a little bit about what your past week of work has been like?
I am here in our sort of guest bed second office in my home in Queen Village in South Philadelphia. and I'm just trying to find a quiet space here. So on the City Hall beat these days, we have a new mayor in Philadelphia and a new city council president and a sort of big hot button issue, which is the 76ers basketball team wanting to build a new arena in Center City. And it's a very controversial proposal. So most of the last week I've spent trying to get to know the folks in the mayor's new administration and trying to get scoops where possible on the Sixers beat.
Okay, that's, yeah, two pretty diverse things. When was the mayor elected, did you say?
The mayor got elected last year. So in Philly, the Democratic primary is really, you know, what matters. So that was in May, and then she was officially elected in the general in November, and she took office in January.
Gotcha. So still pretty fresh. Cool. Well, that gives us a sense of where you are right now, but a big part of the podcast is figuring out how you got to where you are today. And I'd like to start way back at the beginning. If you could tell us a little bit about where you were born, what growing up was like, and if anything planted the seed of interest in journalism early on.
Sure. Well, for me, the beginning is very close to where I am now, like I said, in South Philly. So I grew up in a suburb of Philadelphia, in Newtown, in Bucks County. And my family is all originally from South Philadelphia, so I'm very much now working for my hometown paper at the Inquirer. But I had a couple detours to Evanston, obviously, where we met in college, and internships, and I spent 5 years as a reporter in Texas before coming back to Philadelphia about 4 years ago, maybe 5 years now, actually. So it's kind of a boomerang journey for me.
So, yeah, what was growing up like, and when did you start to get interested in journalism?
Like a lot of people, I think I became interested in journalism because I was definitely stronger in writing and critical thinking in the humanities and stuff like that than I was at math, or at least I had a greater attention span for it when I was growing up. So, you know, in retrospect, I was kind of moving in that direction. I grew up in the suburbs, like I said, in Philly, and I went to an all-boys Catholic high school called Holy Ghost Preparatory School, which a lot of people outside the area get a kick out of.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was a seminary until the 60s, and my uncle went there like in the late 60s. And yeah, so it's a very Philly Catholic type of place. There was a speaker who was an alumnus who came back, and he had a career in journalism that I think involved both business journalism and being a foreign correspondent, actually. So maybe up your alley. And he just came back and spoke at something when I was a senior, and I just remember being very interested in everything he had to say. And so as I was applying to colleges, I applied to journalism school, including to Northwestern. And I don't think I had fully made up my mind that I was going all in on journalism at that point, but Northwestern gave me the most financial aid. So I sort of went sight unseen to Evanston. And then when I got there, you know, they were like, oh, yeah, you're majoring in journalism. I'm like, yeah, but I might change it. And they're like, no, at Northwestern, you're in the school of journalism. You know, we only have one major, I guess, besides marketing. So I would have to, like, reapply to the Weinberg College of Arts and Sciences to change, and it would be a whole rigmarole. So I just decided to roll with it, and I signed up for the Daily Northwestern student newspaper as soon as possible. And that was really, you know, what cemented it for me. I fell in love with it, you know, as soon as I could actually be doing it through the school paper. And as they say, I majored in the school paper, so
sure.
And spent a lot of time in other classes and got to know folks like you at the Daily.
So, wow, it really didn't incubate very long. It was your senior year, you saw this one guy speak, and so applied to the school, got in, and that was kind of that.
Yeah, I guess so. I mean, I left out that I was also like the editor of the high school newspaper, and so I was interested in it. I think the thing that incubated quickly was having sort of a vocational attitude about it, that I'm doing this and I'm all in. That happened sort of gradually, then suddenly, yeah.
Cool, yeah. So you joined your student newspaper in high school. That was more of what I had pictured for you, as most people at the Daily, I feel like, did work for their high school newspaper too. Just out of curiosity, what did your folks do? I mean, did they do anything related and or did they encourage this?
No, not at all. And they were not especially encouraging. They're very supportive, and I'm grateful, but they were not encouraging of me going into journalism. My dad was basically a small business owner. It's sort of a defunct business called being a ticket broker, where it's a little bit like being a professional scalper, but you know, it's above board.
Sure.
And my mom was a teacher for 40 years. And, you know, I think they wanted me to go into something more profitable. And also, they are folks who think, you know, maybe the liberal media is a problem in this country. So they weren't jazzed about that aspect either. But once it was clear I was all in, then they were all in too. And so, yeah, they weren't a deterrent.
Wow. Wow. You really come off as a real deep-rooted Philly guy. I guess I didn't pick that up from you. Like, I don't know, conservative parents, all that. But interesting.
Oh, well, that's interesting to me. Is that a reputation of someone from Philly or an aspect of it, someone from Philly, that they would have conservative parents? I guess it makes sense. Certainly the, like, old school values aspect of it, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I guess I don't know much about Philly. I just kind of picture it like a Boston facsimile for some reason, like the, you know, kind of hard scrabble Boston thing. I just transplant over to Philly and I'm like, it's probably like that.
Yeah, I think that would accurately describe my parents' upbringing. But like I said, I was in the suburbs. So anybody from Philly would be like, you can't say you're from here. So I won't.
Sure, sure. Interesting. Okay, cool. And so you get to Northwestern and yeah, what do you make of it? Why do you join the daily, like, first semester right off the bat? And how do you slip into things so quick?
I did. Yeah, I signed up for the daily, I think, like, during orientation week. And so I joined pretty much immediately. I think I was like the first freshman to join or get on staff in our class, which felt like a very big deal at the time. And now, of course, it doesn't matter that much. But so I just kind of went all in on the daily, really, and just realized it's fun to be a reporter and to have an excuse to ask, like, pretty much anybody any question and to get to know all different parts of campus by having to, you know, report on them, as well as the city that we were in, which is Evanston, not Chicago, right? And so it was actually exciting for me to go to Evanston City Council meetings and to learn about local politics for the first time through that.
Yeah, yeah. And this is what, I mean, we didn't know each other very well in college. But, I mean, we both worked at the paper, but we always remembered who the city council reporters were because that was like the most coveted beat at the paper. And I remember, I believe it was like Danny Yadrin and Megan Crapaud were like the bright, shiny, like on the rise people. And I believe you were the year after them. Is that right?
Yes. They were a year older than me. Yeah.
Gotcha. And who was the city council reporter at the same time as you?
That's a good question. I'm not sure.
These seemed so important back in the day, but yeah, I guess it's kind of.
Well, now I'm like, did I have a co-reporter? And I probably did, but I don't know. but I was on the city desk for a while, though, so it's hard for me to sort out which assignments happened when. Yeah.
Yeah, no, I feel like I just remember some daily party where it was like the baton was being passed from them to you, or maybe it was to them. Anyway, it all kind of fades. Was like Noman Merchant ever your editor on the city desk?
Yeah, well, Noman was a senior when I was a freshman, so I think that's right. So he was the managing editor, or he might have been a junior. Anyway, he was further up the pecking order than being the city editor by the time I arrived. And yeah, Noman was great. I mean, part of what's so valuable about being in the student newspaper as opposed to just majoring in journalism is getting to see and hear other people do the thing, right? So just getting to observe like Noman or whoever on the phone or have them talk through an actual story, not just like a hypothetical story, you know, that was both what, you know, gave me the bug and also what I think, you know, helps you learn more quickly.
Yeah, I mean, I wasn't a journalism major, so I learned most everything at the Daily. I took like 3 classes, but Medill wasn't too fond of outsiders taking their classes, so that's all I could really manage. But I think it was probably enough. I think it was mostly just being like I lived in the communications residential college and like was a part of the Daily and basically knew all those people and was around them. So it kind of rubbed off on me.
Yeah.
How did you find, you know, four years of journalism school? Like looking back now, you know, whatever, almost 15 years later, probably.
Yeah, it was you were there. So it was sort of a time of tumult for the J school itself, for Medill, right? They seemed to not know what they wanted to be during that time. And I wasn't in love with a lot of the curriculum choices that they made. But, you know, it's understandable that that would be a time of feeling compelled to reinvent yourself and there not being really clear answers about, you know, what the future of things like journalism schools will look like. So most of my memories are about the Daily. Like I've, you know, been saying, I spent many, 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 many more hours at the Daily than I did, you know, in class or studying. So I remember it fondly.
Sure, sure. What did you end up being, a managing editor or anything like that?
Yes, I applied to be editor-in-chief and was absolutely rightfully denied that opportunity because Matt Foreman got it, and he did a really good job, and he's a great guy, and I still keep in touch with him, and he made me his managing editor. He's had a fascinating career, by the way. He's no longer in journalism, but so I was managing editor under him. Yeah, that's where I topped out.
Yeah, the name rings a bell, but I can't really place it. I mean, I had been gone my entire junior year and came back senior year and was the opinion page editor. Must have been when we overlapped. Matt Foreman doesn't ring a bell. What did he go on to do? I'm curious.
Yeah, so he was the reason he wouldn't ring a bell for you is because he was on sports before he became editor-in-chief. So I think he was sports editor, I guess. And so he did sports journalism after school for a little bit. He wrote for like Lacrosse Magazine, which is funny. And then he's really at heart a baseball guy. And he wrote for, I think it's like literally called Inside Baseball or Baseball America or something. It's like an insider publication for baseball in which he was doing journalism, but he was essentially like a scout too. He was like kind of writing up reports on players like top to bottom for this team or that team.
Huh.
And then he got hired by the Cleveland Indians to work like in their front office, and he just skyrocketed up the chain and he became the youngest assistant general manager for any baseball team in the country, at least when he got that promotion. And he's still an assistant GM with them, and they had a run to the World Series where they came up short and he was there for that. And so, yeah. Not your usual become a spokesperson or a lawyer after you quit journalism type of trajectory.
Yeah, wow. I talked to one of my last few interviews. The guy's brother was like a baseball GM for like the Astros or something through some like crazy turn of fate with like, you know, when they got hard into the Moneyball statistics, and he had been like a consultant and somehow like ended up as the general manager of a baseball team. Funny how life works out.
Yeah.
What did you do for like your JR, your journalism residency?
Yeah, so I did the JR, which they had recently rebranded at the Seattle Times. I did that in the fall of senior year. And this summer before that, I was at the Reno Gazette Journal. So I just went Reno, Seattle. And you've had Brian on before, so I was basically just following him around through his internship. So he did that before. And that was an awesome experience. I basically did political reporting. That's sort of when I became a political reporter, I would say, is those two internships, because I just got kind of thrown into it. And then that's what all my clips were. So it was an election year. It was 2010. In Nevada, there was the Harry Reid reelection during the Tea Party era against Sharon Angle. And then there was a, you know, a host of congressional races in Washington state when I was up there. So those were just incredible experiences. And as you know, because you're a couple years older than me, so it's probably even more difficult at that time, you know, in that post-recession moment, you either got a job or you just kept like amassing internships. So I don't know. I forget how many I ended up with, but it was a large number. But they were all great. I really loved being an intern.
Yeah. I mean, there were so many people on that kind of internship track, which I just never got on. So I felt like I could never get on it. Like, you needed to be building from like that really small paper to that slightly less small, slightly less, slightly less. Like almost a miniature version of what people's newspaper careers used to be, just, you know, in the like 4 summers after each year of school. But, you know, I just didn't have a first internship, so couldn't get on that track. You know, I eventually interned at a magazine in Beijing, but really didn't happen for me. But I guess what I'm trying to say is I knew people like Noma and like Libby, and it just seemed really fucking stressful, I guess I would say. Like, I mean, did you find like it hyper-competitive? Were you stressed out about like eventually finding a job after college?
I think so. I definitely think it was worse at maybe the worst moment for Noman and Libby's year. I remember like a lot of really talented people were just about completely frozen out for a while. Obviously, they broke through. It was stressful. I do remember you mentioned how it's kind of like a conveyor belt like that. Like once you get on it, it sort of moves forward. So yeah, I interned at like the Advance of Bucks County and the Bucks County Courier Times and like unpaid things while I was living at home in the beginning of college. And, you know, I was also like working at the grocery store and like living with my parents. So those gave me the clips, which got me to Reno, which yada, yada. So you're absolutely right that it's hard to break into that. And at that time, it was really hard to find a paid internship, which Reno luckily did. And it doesn't have to pay much to be able to afford a 20-year-old's lifestyle in Reno. So that was fine. But yeah, it was mostly like the stressful part, I think, was can I string together enough internships so that I don't have a gap and then eventually get a job. But like if there is no job right away, then how can I still be an intern somewhere so I can keep applying? Because in my mind, it would look really bad if I, you know, have been not in school or not working or something for some amount of time. Maybe in retrospect, I was overly stressed about that and didn't need to be, but that was on my mind.
Yeah, no, it's funny how these things seem to last so long, but in retrospect, it was such like a brief period of time. Like I couldn't get anything out of college. Like it was 2009 crisis. So like I took an internship at a literary agency in New York that paid $600 a month and was broke within 4 months, moved back into my parents' house, and then like found a job probably 6 months later at a paper, luckily.
Oh, wow. Yeah. Yeah. That's not enough for New York. Yeah.
Yeah. No. But in retrospect, being out of a job for 6 months wasn't that big of a deal. It felt like an eternity at the time, but everything worked out fine, I guess.
This is terrible, but where's home again?
I'm from Wisconsin.
Okay.
So gotcha. I'm from, yeah, right outside Madison. So yeah. not too far from Northwestern.
Yeah.
But, okay, so you graduate and you're going straight into another internship. How many internships do you have to do before you get a job?
How many did I do? I did at least 7, maybe 8. And so after college, I...
Wow.
Yeah. So there was the two in my hometown, then Reno, then Seattle in school. And then after college, I did the New York Times DC Bureau, had an internship.
Oh, wow.
So I did that. And then the Dallas Morning News DC Bureau. And I did that soon after the Times. So that's 6 right there. So unless I'm missing one, I did 6. Oh, well, technically, I started as an intern at the Philadelphia Daily News, which turned into my first real job. So I'll call it 7. But I sort of knew that that was being set up for me to move into a permanent position eventually. But I had to start as like an intern on the copy desk, and then someone went on maternity leave and I got hired as a temp on the copy desk, and then someone else moved to the AP in the City Hall Bureau, and then I moved into their spot in the City Hall Bureau, and that was my first permanent job, salary $29,000.
Oh, wow. How long was that after you graduated that it became permanent?
That it became permanent? Maybe between 1.5 and 2 years.
Okay, wow. Yeah, having to force your way really into the industry. But yeah, however you need to get your foot in the door, we did it, obviously.
Yeah.
But that also involved going back to Philly, your hometown. How did you feel about that?
I felt fine about it. So actually, that's a big part of the tale as far as how I ended up there, is that toward the end of college, my dad actually passed away from lung cancer. Don't smoke.
Oh, shit.
And
sorry.
It was a long time ago now, but I appreciate that. But anyway, so my first plan, relevant to your podcast, was to be a foreign correspondent. And I studied Swahili in college, and I studied abroad in Uganda. And I had made some contacts, like with bureaus over there. And I applied for, but didn't get, but was a finalist for an AP job over there. And so I don't know if I would have accepted that job if I got it, but I made enough contacts that I knew I could, you know, sell a story a week and live pretty well, you know, in Kampala. And so that was my plan until my dad got sick. And it was actually just the tumult in my family and not wanting to stress my mom out more than she already was, you know, sort of drew me back to Philadelphia. And
sure.
So that was the main motivation. That's why I kind of agreed to this cockamamie thing where I was on the copy desk and then temporary and then permanent, you know, because an editor there, Gar Joseph, who has since passed away, but he's a legend in Philadelphia and a really great guy. He sort of set up that course for me. And so that's how I came back to Philly. And I was really grateful I did, because family was really important at that time and still is. So.
Sure. No, that makes total sense. And yeah, $28,000. Yeah, that.
$29,000.
I got offered a job for $27,000 or $28,000 to work in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania. And I saw like how somebody who was a year ahead of me was living, who was doing this job essentially. And I was like, oh, I can't do this. Like, you know, it's too little. So I took too long to respond. I didn't actually say no. I took like three days and got a really angry email from the editor being like, you know, if you can't make up your mind, like the job's not on the table or something.
Wow.
Like that.
How about that?
And I was like, wow, well, I guess I said no. And then luckily, like a week later, got a job offer in Myrtle Beach, South Carolina for $33,000, which at the time seemed, you know, so much better.
A much better view.
Yeah. That's true.
Well, that's actually, it's funny you say that about Harrisburg, because this is kind of a perpetual thing with Philadelphia journalism and politics, that, you know, people would rather be in Philly than Harrisburg, which most of my other experience, like I mentioned, was in Austin, and it's sort of the opposite. You know, both the journalists and the small town politicians want to like graduate to Austin, right, and move to Austin. And in Philly, you have the opposite scenario. A state representative from Philly doesn't want to go to Harrisburg. They end up like having to go to Harrisburg. The current mayor talks about how she was like kind of forced to go to Harrisburg when she was a state rep. And then once you get an opportunity to like get a city council seat, then you take that. So you go down from state to local government, but it's a more influential and desirable job for the politicians. And similarly, it's always hard for the Harrisburg-based publications to recruit. Which is a shame, because there's a lot of great stories out there and there are very good journalists out there covering them. So, yeah, it's just an interesting dynamic how that works. But I would take the Myrtle Beach offer too, so I don't blame you.
Yeah. No kidding. But yeah, Harrisburg, like, I mean, it was an opportunity. It's just the pay was so bad. And I saw like the place Laura Olson was living in and was just like, oh, this is by myself out here, not a lot going on in Harrisburg.
That's right. I forgot about that. She was with the Morning Call, right?
Yeah, and she had been with, I think she had started with this publication, Capital Wire, maybe?
Yeah. Wow, okay.
So yeah, I don't know if that exists anymore. I saw that the guy died kind of tragically and early a few years ago. Blanking on the guy's name, but hopefully they still exist.
Yeah, I'm not sure, actually. Yeah. But she moved on to D.C. for them, I think, right?
Yeah. Everything turned out fine. Got to pay your dues somehow, I suppose. Let's see. So you get on this paper, and I mean, this is the Philadelphia Daily News. You work at the Philadelphia Inquirer now. Does the Daily News still exist?
The Daily News sort of exists in name only now. it just is our articles at the Enquirer, and they redesign it in Daily News style, and they emphasize different things. But unfortunately, and because it was great for the city when we had real two-paper competition, unfortunately that they're not really independent anymore. It was always the same company, but there were two really separate and really fiercely competitive staffs for a long time. And then they merged, and a lot of folks at the Daily News got laid off, sadly, and the other folks got sort of absorbed into the Enquirer.
Gotcha. And so what? Give me some highlights of your time there before you made your first move.
Working for the Daily News was, in retrospect, just a great experience. And also, we did really hilarious stuff because it was a tabloid. I mean, it's sort of more like the New York Daily News than the New York Post. You know, it won a Pulitzer. Wendy Ruderman and Barbara Laker won a Pulitzer there right before I got there for investigative reporting. So it did really serious work, but it also took the tabloid part really seriously, too. So Gar Joseph, that legendary editor, you know, it was like I would submit an expense report and it would have like one beer and a salad on it with a source or something. He'd be like, why is there only one beer on here? And I was like, I don't know if I was allowed to submit more. And he was like, well, how are they going to talk to you if you don't get them drunk? I was like, okay, I'll get back out there. And, you know, we did like Photoshopped covers, you know, making fun of the mayor all the time. I recently caught up with the mayor at that time, Michael Nutter, and I was like, I just want to, like, you know, I don't take anything back, but I just want to give a light apology to you for being, you know, a pretty annoying thorn in your side, I think, for a couple years at the end of your the end of your administration. And he like looked at me really sincerely and said thanks. But, you know, like there was a tax review board appeal hearing on the strip clubs were appealing whether the hospitality tax applies to lap dances and things like that. And Gar wanted like breathless coverage of every hearing of that, which is not something that would happen at the Enquirer. but then again, he also wanted, you know, me to report on patronage jobs at the parking authority. And I like sort of staked out a toll booth at the airport to see if they were really working and that type of thing. So he wanted serious stories too, but he also wanted us to produce stories that would sell the paper. And his mantra was almost all of the Daily News readership comes from single copy sales, not from subscribers. So he's like, we need something on the front page every day that will make you stop and buy it. And so that was his driving force.
Wow. Do you remember any of your very serious stories getting hilarious headlines or anything like that, just out of curiosity?
That's a good question. No, it was more like, I'm going to write this one tabby, or, you know, I'm going to try to be very serious about it.
Give me some ridiculous tabloid stories you did.
Sure. So, like, the Nutter, the mayor at the time, would, like, seemingly strategically curse every once in a while. So we did like a compilation of that. And, you know, actually this has become a thing that a lot of publications have done recently because of Trump, obviously. And now our current governor, actually, this same story sort of came up, but he always seemed like he was cursing, like to generate a little more attention for what he was saying. So we tried to kind of neg him for that. And, I even created like a little crossword in which like you fill in, you know, it was the quote from the mayor was the clue with the blank for the curse, and you fill in the curse word in a, like a tiny little crossword. And so they did like a Photoshop of him like screaming obscenities, like with, you know, asterisk or whatever. And I think he was in a hot air balloon, like flying over the city and like screaming curse words or something. I forget what the pun was. It must have been hot air or something, you know. So that was one example of that.
Yeah, that's great. And I mean, any other story highlights, serious or otherwise?
I'd say on the serious stuff, it's more like, you know, I think every journalist has this thing where they look back at a story and they kind of cringe at how they wrote it or, you know, the choices they made. So, you know, I had heard a lot about developers in the council district that was occupied by the council president, feeling like they can't get anything done in that district unless they give money to his campaign. And so I did a story that kind of laid out their complaints. And it started strong. And then, you know, I just didn't know how to structure a story at the time. And basically, I structured it like, here's the accusation in the top. Like, the middle section is just like kind of a discussion of the issues, like the context, like the history of it or whatever. And then I put like all of my evidence, like really dry stuff, like in this one weird final section that took up like 40% of the story. And it was just like, on this date, this person gave this money. On this date, the redevelopment authority approved this property. On this date, this other person gave this much money. And so, my main memory of the quote, good work I did back then is like, boy, I wish I could do that differently now.
Yeah. They wouldn't like really tear up your articles and put them back together again or anything like that.
Not for the serious stuff. I did for the fun stuff. Gar would sometimes just like send a note back and be like, tab it up. He used tab as like a verb. Like, I need this more tabby or something like that, you know? And so I had to write a punchier lead or make fun of someone in the lead or something like that.
I love that. Wow. Tab it up.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. No, I mean, that jives with my experience in like Myrtle Beach, for example. It was, in retrospect, the lightest touch editing ever. Like, they would, you know, edit for grammar and stuff like that and maybe make me change around a lead. But like the amount of space and like you could just write whatever, basically. I mean, in retrospect, it was a lot of freedom that I guess maybe I should have valued or used better. But I don't know. I would say, like, looking back at that time, it's also a time when I took myself probably a little bit too seriously as a journalist and, like, was running around to these, you know, small town politics type stuff and taking it like it's life and death. And, like, people would try to talk to me off the record and I'd be like, no. Like, everything's on the record.
Oh, you were one of those? You didn't go off the record?
No. Like, they really, like, in the three classes I took, like, they really drilled that into you. And in retrospect...
Do you still do that?
No. Like, in retrospect, I talk to people off the record all the time.
Oh, yeah. That's, like, 90% of my conversations are off the record.
But I guess you have to get past the Journalism 101 class for them to tell you that.
Well, I remember... That's interesting you say. It came up a few times at Medill, because I took a class with Alex Kotlowitz, who's obviously... He wrote... You know, There Are No Children Here, and he does big, hefty pieces, if not books, you know. And, you know, so he can spend a lot of time on a story and, like, pretty much nail everything down, right? So he doesn't, like, need to find out what the thing is off the record to go prove it on the record type of thing, you know? and I get the idea that you don't want to be trapped into, like, not being able to use information because it came to you off the record. And I totally respect that and would love to do that. But yeah, in like a fast churn political reporting situation, if I wasn't speaking to people off the record, I don't know what I would get. I guess maybe I should like experiment with this for 1 week or something. But no, I've never attempted that.
I've always wondered the how that works because there was some like Wall Street Journal reporter I think who was legendary for never talking to anybody off the record, but. I feel like it's like a long-term strategy and you have to like really commit and I just don't see how it would be that workable, like you say, but who knows? Maybe once we're super well established or something like that, we could pull it off.
Maybe.
So how long were you there and what was your next move?
I was there for about 2 years. And my next move was down to Texas. Part of my motivation was, so far in my career, I've been pretty good at like seeing the walls close in around me and start applying to jobs at that point. So I've done that twice now, and this was the first one. So there were, you know, like I just described, the merger of the newsrooms between the Inquirer and the Daily News, which mostly negatively affected the Daily News folks. I mean, I don't know. Maybe they would have kept me. I don't know. We have a union, so there's some seniority stuff. So I was just like, maybe I should get out of here. And then I also had some personal life stuff pulling me to Texas. And so, you know, I just applied for jobs in the Austin area and then ended up as the Hays County reporter for the Austin American Statesman, which was a great gig.
Yeah, wow. But Texas, very different from Philly, very different from maybe some similarities with Reno. But yeah, how did you find it? Had you ever been there before? And how was it now on your second job? Do you think you had figured stuff out better by then?
Yeah, I think it was coming together. I had only been to Texas like for a conference. So I hadn't really been. And yeah, it was different. I mean, and I was covering, like I said, Hays County, which is like a relatively undeveloped, or at that point, it was a relatively undeveloped county outside of Austin in sort of the border of the Hill Country. And so it wasn't like Austinlandia, you know, it wasn't like a liberal transplant. So
right.
I would be, you know, at a meeting or something. And I remember this county judge, Burke Cobb, was like, "You're not from here, are you?" And I was like, "No, I'm not." And he was okay with that. But what he really wanted to know is if I was from California. And that would have been bad news for our relationship. He does not like the LA people moving into the Austin area. So I said, "I'm from Philadelphia." And I could see him kind of like scan his mind. And he was like, "All right, well, whatever." And then we just moved on. So I passed that test.
No pre-existing prejudice against people from Philadelphia, at least. That's good.
Yeah, I guess he wasn't a Cowboys fan. So, yeah.
So what kind of stuff were you covering there? I mean, you said it wasn't very developed at the time. I mean, was that part of the story? Was it developing, or what were you covering?
Oh, yeah, it was developing. It was the fastest growing, as a percentage, city in the country, San Marcos, which is the county seat, for like 5 years running or something.
Wow.
Which means this like tiny, tiny town grew to like 50,000 overnight. It doesn't mean that it was huge. But so it was a lot of kind of tension between development and preserving the Hill Country. And one thing I really enjoyed reporting on there, which I did not do at all before, was reporting on water, which down there they say water. And it's just like a whole world of politics that is all contained in this one issue. And I found it interesting because it kind of can create strange bedfellows politically. You know, there's the property rights people who might be against the big company, and they're both like pretty conservative Republicans, but their interests conflict in that instance. So that was really fascinating.
Yeah. And how long were you in Austin?
I was in Austin for a total of 5 years, almost exactly. So in the beginning, I was the Hays County reporter, and then I covered the county that Austin is in, and then I moved to the state legislature beat, and then I moved to the investigative team. So I kind of did a number of different jobs there. So in the beginning, it was all county, and by the end, it was pretty much all state government-focused stuff.
Okay, cool. And give me some of the highlights of stories you worked on there.
I covered the 2017 session of the Texas legislature, and my beat was the House and the budget. And it was a really wild session. I think it was sort of the moment, or one of the few sessions that were a tipping point moment that led to the Texas state government we have today. Back then, it was like deciding between truly moderate Republicans and the Tea Party types. And now we're talking like Tea Party versus whatever's further to the right, you know. And there were all-night hearings on Sanctuary City legislation, which became really emotional. Obviously, every year they do an abortion bill. And there was a literal fight between state representatives on the floor of the Texas House on the final day of the session. And I was sort of in the vicinity. And the, like, administration committee chair is kind of like the inside baseball chair. He sort of, like, oversees the House. It was this amazing Texas character named Charlie Guerin. He, for some reason, thought that I was part of it or instigated it or something. And he tried to, like, kick me out of the floor, of the House floor. And then people, like, talked him out of it. And they were like, "Sean wasn't anywhere near that, actually." Well, I'm sure what he saw was me running over to it and trying to ask people who were part of it, you know, what happened. So he probably thought I was, like, in the scrum by the time he started looking at it. But that was really shocking, and a perfect encapsulation of that legislative session, which in retrospect, the far right has won, right? You know, now the Texas legislature pumps out, without that much fighting, stuff that is way more conservative than what was on the table that led to those fights.
And when you moved to the investigative team, that must have been a big shift. I mean, so much of like what you and I did from the daily for the first many years of our career was about working a beat, and being an investigative journalist is not working a beat. How was that?
It was great. I was on a team. We had four or five of us at different points who were all really amazing reporters who were all still working. And we've all kind of scattered because things are not good at the Austin paper now. But they are all really seasoned, experienced people. This is Tony Plahetsky, Andrea Ball, Jeremy Schwartz, and Eric Dexheimer. And we had a great editor, Robert Eckhart. And, you know, I learned just like an immense amount. I was only on the team for about a year before I moved back to Philly. We did one major group project that won an SBJ award that was led by Andrea, and that was on daycare safety. And, you know, it was always a goal of mine to work on projects, like capital P projects, where you go into the submarine and come back up 6 months later, you know. I'm grateful I was able to get my first exposure to that by working with them, because, like you said, it's a major lifestyle change from the churn. And for the first 6 months I was on the team, frankly, I was like just stressing out that my name wasn't in the paper. And I ended up doing these like kind of quick hit, like smaller investigations, like every 2 weeks, just to like, you know, relieve my stress. And then I kind of leaned into it. I did a long form profile of Lieutenant Governor Dan Patrick, which I'm pretty proud of. And then I was really grateful to contribute to that daycare series. And then Gatehouse Media bought the Statesman, and I started applying to jobs elsewhere.
So, I mean, you describe this team, and I basically picture the movie Spotlight. It's like six people working in a room. This sounds like five people working in a room. Is it kind of like that?
It was exactly like that, actually. I mean, we were in the corner of the newsroom as opposed to in a separate room, but it was like that. You know, we met once a week and had ideas, and sometimes we worked as a group, and sometimes everybody was pursuing their own ideas. And they are people who are like seasoned investigative folks. I'm back on the beat now in City Hall in Philly. So, you know, I think I'll go back to that eventually, that type of thing eventually. But they were really used to the routine of what are my three goals this year, you know, which for me, I'm like, what are my three goals before City Council meets on Thursday, you know?
Right.
So it was like that. It was fun to have that year where I got exposed to the sort of Spotlight lifestyle. Yeah.
No, and I mean, I hear you about all that. I mean, I too get a little bit nervous when like my name hasn't been on the wire in a while. And, you know, I try to have that long-term perspective. And I know deep down that at the end of the year, if you've done like three stories you're really proud of, like that was a good year. And that's what you might remember, but still, I have a lot of difficulty dealing with that, like not being published for a while. It kind of does start to drive me crazy.
Yeah.
But that might have something to do with the fact that the era we came up in, when we were always kind of looking out for our next thing, had to, you know, be like sharks, keep swimming to stay alive, because we were afraid otherwise we would just get like booted from the industry.
Yeah. I mean, I still sort of have that fear. So.
Yeah. Yeah.
I definitely identify with that, yeah.
And so this was the era when I had last seen you. I can't remember what you were doing or how long you had been there, but I remember I went out to drinks with you and with Brian Rosenthal, who was there, who you mentioned you were kind of following in his footsteps, and yeah, all the way to Austin. He was working at a different paper than you, right? Is that right?
Yeah, he was in the Austin Bureau of the Houston Chronicle, and I'm still in touch with Brian, and we're friends, and I need to note that our careers diverged after that, because he went to the New York Times and won a Pulitzer, and I went home, which I'm very happy with. But but it was a sort of running joke we had before, where I sort of followed him to Reno, followed him to Seattle, followed him to Austin accidentally. Yeah, so we were competitors-ish, depending on the story, when we were in Austin, and we played like basketball and ping pong together when we weren't working against each other. So yeah.
And I remember like somebody poking fun at him for like being a workaholic, basically like sleeping on the couch in the office and stuff like that, something to that effect.
Oh yeah,
this was a long time ago, broad brushstrokes. And I remember him saying something about, oh, you just done some story about special ed, and you know, I'm coming in from China, and I'm like, yeah, Brian, whatever. And this, like, I did not, you know, he was not selling it to the, I didn't understand how big of a deal it was until like, yeah, later that one was nominated for a Pulitzer, I believe. And then he gets hired by the Times. And I was like, oh, I should have probably, you know, not blown that off as whatever, but.
No, it's good to put Brian in his place. It's important. I'm just kidding. And he handles it well when you tease him about that. He reports to me that he has mellowed and he has work-life balance these days, and that he doesn't need to sleep in the office anymore and all that. So I'm very thankful for him that happened for him, because it was definitely unsustainable for a while.
Yeah. He was asking me if he should get a cat, and I was like, yeah, you should do that. It'll force you to chill out a little bit. But I feel like within 6 months he had a girlfriend, and now he's married, and that has helped also. Maybe he didn't need the cat.
Yes. I think he's in a good place now. Yeah.
Cool. And so, yeah, what happens next? What takes you back to Philly again?
In the, you know, survive and advance career trajectory of journalism, basically Gatehouse, which has since rebranded, bought the Statesman, which was previously owned by the Cox family, which has the cable company, but also has had newspapers for like more than a century and was actually really good to the Statesman employees and had good benefits even in, you know, non-union Austin and all that. It was like a Will Hurst bias or Will Gatehouse bias kind of conundrum for a few months. And then once Gatehouse won the bidding, I decided to start looking elsewhere. I ended up meeting a lot of the folks on the journalism side there, and they were totally nice. And I think they wanted me to stick around. And obviously they've acquired USA Today and Gannett and rebranded as Gannett, even though it's really the Gatehouse company that is in control. And
oh, I didn't know that. Huh.
Yeah. But, you know, they're the bigger picture with them, even though I liked the folks that they had on their journalism side, the bigger picture with them is, you know, they have private equity style financing. It's really, you know, a lot of debt went into buying the Statesman, and the Statesman has really shrunk, really sadly. There's been articles in Texas Monthly about this. You know, it's sort of a shell of its former self, unfortunately. And so I was imagining that something like that might happen. And I think I also knew that, you know, I liked my time in Austin, but I wasn't a Texas lifer and I wanted to get back to the Northeast and closer to family. So the Inquirer sort of recreated its City Hall Bureau right around that time. And I just sent a couple emails and then went through the process and got picked. And that was about 2019.
And yeah, no, that's good timing. 2019, just before the pandemic. And back to City Hall reporting, which you had done before back in Evanston, although it's obviously much higher stakes in Philly. And I imagine, like you said, a pretty coveted beat there. Like city politics is maybe viewed higher than, not maybe, viewed higher than Harrisburg politics. Did you feel, I don't know, did you feel like you had arrived by the, when you got that job, or how did you feel going into that?
I think that's right. I felt really good about being back in Philly and covering City Hall for the Inquirer. I loved the Daily News, but I kind of always had a goal in college of writing for the Inquirer at some point. And I specifically loved the City Hall beat. I just love like the political factions and tribes that you have in Philly politics and how that gets kind of passed down. And I felt like I had a pretty good understanding for how it worked. And so I was excited for the beat in particular.
You know, we know a lot of people have moved to New York and D.C. and work for big media outlets and things like that. But like, it's like you and like Megan Kripo and others. I mean, you work in Chicago, you know, in a former era, Philly in a former era. These were like Titan newspapers and they were like totally a place you would want to end up. But now it's been clear like what the trajectory is of like 99% of newspapers, unless they're like the Washington Post or the New York Times, is tough. Like it's just tough. And I guess I've started asking one question about the pandemic and kind of transitioned into something else. But I guess I don't know like how it was in the pandemic for a publication like yours on a beat like yours, where it's very much this meetings driven thing. You are out there all the time working the beat. Like you physically can work the beat in a way that many beats, if you're covering, you know, a national beat, or I'm covering all of Brazil or all of China, like, you know, it's not as physical, like you don't go to this place and do this thing. How was that for you? Long wind up, sorry.
No, all good. Yeah, during the pandemic, it was just unbelievable, you know, covering City Hall, because even though I guess the vaccine gets created, you know, in a lab and it's for the whole country and everything, it just was, people had a desperate need for information. And in Philly, they know their elected officials and they know the mayor. And so it did feel really, really intense. And like the city opened a COVID hospital for homeless folks who didn't have a place to quarantine. And that was like one block away from my apartment. And then George Floyd happened, and I had like the breaking news shift that day. And I was like there when the first car blew up and like a thing flew by my head. And, you know, it did really feel like, oh, the national news of the world is happening, not just on my beat, but like within a 5-block radius of my apartment, which I'm sure is an experience that reporters had across the country. And at the same time, the amount of attention or focus that people had on their local government officials and on what we were writing about them felt like an all-time high. I mean, we had thousands and thousands of readers who were just kind of watching city council hearings or the mayor's press conferences, which usually only I watch and tell you about, you know, and they're all watching because they're like at home and they're curious. And then they're like sending me their feedback on like, actually, Kenny said this, or what he meant with that. And it's like, all right, that's a good point, you know? And so it was a really interesting experience. I think like a lot of journalists, it was closer to me being burnt out than it was to me being like bored and stuck inside, just because it was an insane news event. And so one day it was nursing homes, then, you know, and then the protests, and, you know, so it was kind of just this fire hose that never stopped. And at the end of it, I think I was pretty out of it for like 6 months after like the crazy crush of the news ended, I think, in retrospect. But yeah, it was a fascinating assignment on the local level.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I got pretty burned out through the pandemic, but we were like, yeah, I was like chained to my computer basically. You know, covering the news that way, working the phone, et cetera, you know, only got sent out for a couple pretty tense assignments, you know, wildfires and stuff like that, where you're either like, you're wearing the N95 mask for two reasons, for the wildfire smoke and for getting COVID.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
But like, it was like very intense, brief, and then you would go back to being in hiding, chained to your computer on your couch, watching the presser on TV or whatever.
Yeah, that must have been fascinating, especially writing for an international audience too.
Yeah. No, it was a hugely productive period for my career. Like, and yeah, just like I got really burned out from it. But yeah, no, it was good in the short run, I guess. But did you ever question, should I go out? Should I cover this? That's what I always wonder also, like, you know, or you're like, this is my job, so you were going to do it. Or were you like, put me in, coach? I want to go out to that homeless hospital a block from me.
I think I was closer to put me in, coach. And I feel extremely compelled to say that there were folks at the Inquirer who were really on the front lines, like more than me. If I was at like a 7, they were at a 10, like, especially because it became a major public safety crisis in Philadelphia. And so our sort of cops beat reporters really shined and did a lot of work that was really intense in that regard. So I was down for any political thing that happened. I wasn't like shy about wanting to go out, except for maybe in a couple instances, which I can't remember the details of. But I was on the eager side to go out. But I was, you know, I was single, I didn't have kids, and I was in an apartment in Center City where a lot of stuff was happening. And so I felt like, you know, why not me and not other people have more complicated situations. And also it was just, you know, what was happening on my beat. So, and amazingly, I have never gotten COVID once that I know of. So.
Oh, wow. Yeah,
if there is an immunity, I think I have it.
Oh, wow. That's crazy. Okay. So that catches us up to where we are today. You're a City Hall reporter at the Philadelphia Inquirer. So I think we can move on to talk about some stories. The next section, we'll talk about two stories. And I like to start with the story that got away because it's more of a downer, so we can end on a high note. If you can think of a story any time in your career that didn't work out for whatever reason, either, you know, the editor wouldn't accept the idea, the key source wouldn't speak to you, the reporting went horribly wrong, like any reason, it's really to highlight some of the challenges in journalism. So is there any notable story that got away for you?
Sure. There's one that's difficult for me to talk to because it did get away from me, but is definitely the answer to your question for my career. Apologies in advance for being a little vague, but so it was a Me Too story that didn't happen when I was in Texas. And this high-profile person is accused of something in the Me Too genre. And, you know, the tipster comes to me. And, you know, I get on a plane with my editor's thumbs up for a cross-country flight. And I've been talking to this person for a week. And I get there. And, you know, I'm trying to meet with them and they're not responding. And then it's just like not coming together. And then finally, I'm told by a third party that they have, you know, made contact with everybody involved, including the accuser, and that, like, the plug is being pulled. And I had nothing on the record at that point. And the reason we don't publish these things is because, you know, that means I didn't get a chance to vet everything. But it was shocking the way it played out. And the reason I'm bringing it up actually is because it was sort of credibly suggested to me at one point that they were using me to, you know, create an incentive for, you know, the arrangement, whatever it ended up being, I was never able to find out, for the arrangement to be kept secret. So that they kind of had this plan all along and they never wanted a story. And that I was just sort of like one of their bargaining chips. And I tried to prove all that, but, you know, it was all gossip and I had nothing firsthand. And that one was absolutely the story that got away.
Yeah, that stings. Wow. They set you up, basically.
That may or may not be the case, but that was what was suggested to me after the fact. Which, you know, might mean that maybe there wasn't all that much to it in the first place. So, who knows?
Well, it sounds like probably everybody got an NDA to sign and to pay off. So
potentially.
I guess that's how it often goes. Not usually, but I mean, that sucks.
It was jaw-dropping. I was kind of like impressed, actually.
No, if somebody can pull off a House of Cards type move like that, yeah, I guess respect.
Right.
Okay. And then, yeah, to then go to a high note, if you could take a story that you're proud of and tell us the story behind the story. So, you know, how you came up with the idea or how you got the tip or whatever, or how you got, if you got assigned it, you know, how reporting it out went, writing, publication, reaction, the whole process.
The biggest story within the story of the Philadelphia mayor's race last year was this ethics board investigation that has since kind of fallen apart into this notable candidate. He was like an outsider to government. He owns ShopRites and he doesn't share Trump's politics at all, but he was kind of going to be like the businessman outsider in the Democratic primary. So he's kind of the get the bums out of City Hall, Trump style rhetoric, you know, person in the race. So I think the expectations for this candidate, who is Jeff Brown, were that, you know, maybe he's going to catch fire and people are going to be in love with him. And maybe because he's a first time candidate, you know, who doesn't seem to love politics, that he'll make a bunch of rookie mistakes and get in trouble. And both of those things ended up happening. So he jumps out of the gate with this like super PAC that was of a kind that we haven't really had in Philly politics before. It was a dark money group. Most of our super PACs are funded by labor. So their money is all kind of known. You know, they could hide it, but they don't, because it's just the members pay dues, transfer it from, you know, the electrician's PAC to the super PAC, you know, whatever. And so he was using like a PAC that appeared to have millions of dollars from anonymous donors. And so because of that, he was able to get on TV way earlier than other candidates and, you know, was able to make a big splash. And he was arguably a front runner early on. And that would have been seismic if he ended up winning. So he makes a series of missteps that are unrelated to the thing I'm going to talk about, sort of rookie mistakes. Didn't get Michelle Obama's permission to use a video of them together, and then she criticized his, which is, you don't want Michelle Obama on your bad side if you're running for mayor of Philadelphia. And so she issued a statement saying it was like manipulated, or, you know, and that was bad news for him. But there were always these questions about his seemingly unnecessarily complicated arrangements for his PACs and his campaign. And I got the scoop that the ethics board was investigating, and we had heard about it because people had gotten subpoenas, people had been interviewed. And so I was really pressing for it. And then someone confirmed on the record to me, you know, that they had been interviewed by the ethics board as part of this. And then that was the day before the first and most high-profile televised debate. And, you know, it really just kind of set the thing on fire for his campaign.
Wow.
Because he was unexpectedly on the defense and all of that. You know, so I'm trying to pry things out of the ethics board and also just trying to figure out what's actually going on here. So I end up doing this kind of like inside the ethics board's investigation type of piece. And the part that I'm proud of is that I actually got to the crux of the matter within that piece, and it ended up being a lot more complicated, and the case ended up getting dropped after the election, actually, and now he's on the offensive, and he has sued the ethics board. And so it was sort of a pretty technical legal thing where two different parts of the ethics board's regulations didn't really align. You knew what they were going for, but because they didn't really align, it didn't accomplish what the ethics board hoped it would accomplish. And I don't know how in the weeds you want to get with campaign finance stuff, but, you know, both sides were pretty confident they were right. And my article was kind of like, this is like a gray area, you know? And my story behind the story is actually that, you know, I debated whether to say, as like Sean, as a reporter who's not a lawyer, you know, this is really the heart of the matter, like these two definitions in this regulation. And I went back and forth, and I did a lot of great, I think, like source reporting that got me to be the guy on that story. But then the one story that I did that really nailed what ended up being the crux of it was just, you know, literally reading the document and just doing like if this, then that type of logic that I think ended up, you know, clarifying it earlier on than would have been the case for our readers. Didn't end up going well for Jeff Brown, unfortunately, just the fact of an investigation and his opponents pouncing on him and then other mistakes he made sort of sank his chances. So he went from first and ended up finishing fifth in the primary by the end of the day. But yeah, that was probably the story within the mayor's race that I was most proud of.
Yeah, wow. And yeah, such timing, the day before the debate. Wow.
Well, that's part of his beef with the ethics board, is he thinks they dropped it right before the debate just to mess with him. I don't have any reason to believe that that's true based on like what I've seen in their back and forth. But, you know, for him, I think he thought, I'm the political outsider and here they are coming for me, you know, the day when it makes the most impact.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. And I mean, I guess without getting too into the weeds, I mean, basically, they thought there was a violation of campaign finance law, and he, you know, the PAC money wasn't staying within the lines of the law or something like that.
Yeah. Basically it's the familiar debate we've been having since Citizens United on coordination. So super PACs can raise and spend money in unlimited amounts with anonymous donors if they never coordinate with the candidate or campaign, right? So he was basically raising money for it, and this is not contested. He was raising money for this group that became the super PAC that supported him, at least up until a few weeks before he launched his campaign. And his stores, his like grocery stores, like gave money to it. So he was involved with the organization. Then he launches his campaign, and then he says, now I sever ties with it. And most places, and in federal and state elections, most places, you know, that's acceptable, basically, like in practice, if not in the letter of the law, because there's no enforcement, like the FEC doesn't do anything anymore, you know. But in Philly, we have a pretty aggressive ethics board with strong regulations. And one of those regulations said, you know, you can't do anything coordinated for 12 months before the date of the election. But it said a campaign can't do that. And then the definition of campaign is someone who has announced their candidacy or filed paperwork. So the question is, does it look back 12 months regardless of when you make your announcement as a candidate or not? And that 12-month issue ended up being sort of the crux of the matter.
Interesting. Okay, wow. So yeah, that's a big story, you know, tip of mayor's race in one of the biggest cities in the United States. What was the reaction like?
I mean, he just really fell off the cliff after that. I think he probably would have ended up not winning, if I had to guess, just as a prognosticator. Again, you don't want to piss off Michelle Obama if you're running for mayor of Philadelphia. So I think he probably wouldn't have won anyway, but that was really when it all kind of crashed down. And then there was this sort of post-Jeff Brown moment where there was a Bernie Sanders-style progressive, and there's the person who's the current mayor, who's most often compared to Eric Adams. She's a black woman who's tough on crime, so that's sort of her profile, or at least was during the mayor's race. You know, so it became, after he was effectively out of contention, then the other candidates started to get more oxygen, and it became, you know, the mayor's race part two, basically.
And if you're able to, yeah, I want to know a bit about the award. How did that all go down?
Yeah, it's the Toner Prize for Political Reporting, and I didn't even know we entered it, and I didn't know that they had a local journalism category. I have heard of the Toner, and it's a great award administered by Syracuse. But so we as a team, the politics team at the Enquirer, have won that award for coverage of the mayor's race, including some really interesting data stuff that I was not a part of, but I think probably was, you know, the shiny object that made our portfolio stand out, where they kind of grouped the different types of Philadelphia voters based on past election patterns, like voting patterns. So that was really neat. And then my profile of the mayor when she was a candidate is in there. And yeah, so it's nice to be recognized, because for Philly, that felt like the only thing last year, right? But glad some of our reporting was legible to folks outside of Philly as well.
Yeah, that's great. Congratulations. Yeah.
Thanks.
You know, I'm sure that, you know, the data and slick stuff helps, but, you know, I'm sure it's probably about it being well-rounded. And it sounded like you guys reported the hell out of the race, so well-deserved in that respect.
Thanks.
Let's see. Okay, cool. So, I mean, that's the story section. So next up is the lightning round. It's faster-paced questions, but feel free to answer as short or long as you like. Do you feel ready?
Sure.
First question is, if you could shout out a publication that covers an area you cover or have covered before that you think does a particularly good job but might not be known by everyone.
Sure. I feel like the Texas Observer deserves all the love that it can get. It is the scrappy, investigative, I think, former magazine in Austin that has a real eye for calling out BS in the state capitol. And I think encouraging folks to read that would be great.
Next up, what is a publication you read, listen to, or watch for fun? So it can be any medium, text, audio, video, whatever, but something you look at more for fun that is still journalistic in nature.
Would you count history podcasting?
Yeah, sure, why not?
Well, it's nonfiction in nature. It's not journalistic. But I feel like I have no other answer now, because I am in like a deep history podcast phase of my life, and I probably need someone to pull me out of it. But I've done the Byzantine Empire. I've done, you know, Rome, obviously. But, you know, I'm in Peru right now. So, yeah, and there's a whole community and a whole vibe to history podcasting, you know, a range of like amateur to professional historian types of voices, and I've really enjoyed being sucked into it.
I guess what's one you're into right now, like, to name a specific one?
Sure. Well, I don't want to name one of the big ones, but if I'm going to give a shout out, I guess I would say The History of the Inca, which is the one I'm listening to right now. And he does a pretty good job of telling you everything you wanted to know and a little bit more about the people of the Andes.
And then to get a little bit more specific, what is the best journalistic article, piece, or again, whatever medium that you have consumed recently? So to name a kind of a more specific story or piece that left an impression with you.
Sure. Ellie Rushing, who is my colleague at the Enquirer and does just incredible work that I am not capable of doing for even 2 minutes, covering public safety and gun violence crisis in Philadelphia. She recently did a story that was focusing on the children who were murdered in Philadelphia in, I think it was for 2023. And she really told their story and their family story, and it was very personal. And I think when you cover that beat and it is that sad that often, you know, it's hard to make things stand out, you know, to get something across to your readers that there's something you ought to pay attention to with this piece. And I think anyone who read that piece stopped in their tracks. So
what was the name of it, if people want to look it up?
It was called Forever Young: The 24 Children Who Were Killed in 2023 in Philadelphia.
Wow. Yeah, that's heavy.
Yeah, I'm not cut out for that. I don't know if this goes earlier in the podcast, but, you know, I just don't have what it takes to be a gun violence or public safety reporter like that in a place like Philadelphia. And I really admire folks who do. And I consider political reporting to be way easier, you know, both in terms of sourcing and also obviously the emotional fortitude to do that every day. So I really admire Ellie and my other colleagues who focus on that.
Yeah. Well, is there any particular subject matter you geek out about that isn't related to your job? And you already gave us history podcasts, so I won't press you too hard on this one, but anything else come to mind?
I would say I'm a big fan of jazz. Love Coltrane, love our Philly native jazz artists in particular, and saxophonists in particular. Yeah, again, I geek out pretty hard on jazz, and we've got a couple venues left here in Philadelphia, so I try to go to them.
Oh, that's great. If you had to trade places with one journalist, living or dead, and you would have their career, who would it be?
My answer is going to be David Barstow of the New York Times, just because he's an insanely prolific investigative reporter who I think has chosen really cool and interesting stories to go deep on. You know, when I was an intern there, I think I badgered him to get coffee with me, and that was really great, and I doubt he remembers me, which is all good. So I don't have a super good sense of like how stressful that lifestyle is to be like expected to churn out Pulitzers for like a year and a half long story. And, you know, so I don't know. I want to say I admire his career most. I would have to learn more about how stressful it is before deciding to trade places. But I'm going to stick with that as my answer.
Sure. And for people who don't know him well offhand who are listening, I mean, he's won a ton of awards. Just pick something he's particularly known for, a couple things.
Yeah, he won a Pulitzer for reporting on all the like sort of local government bribery that went on for Walmart's expansion in Mexico, which is like, man, how'd you decide to focus on that, you know? But it was like great. I think he called it, or someone called it, like the greatest zoning story ever told. And then another one, I think this one might be the one that I was like, that's cool, you know, about is, it was about all the different generals and military brass, or former military brass, I think probably more accurately, who would be commentators on the news during the like height of the war on terror and talking about Iraq. And, you know, I think he got a tip or just looked at it and was like, you know, it's probably not a coincidence that all these guys are popping up with these credentials and these talking points. And he sort of strung together that it was part of a messaging machine. You know, it just seemed like this random general really wanted to tell the viewers about why the invasion was worthwhile, and it turns out it was like a very slick PR design, basically.
Yeah, wow. Yeah, I'd like to hear the story behind the story on those ones, how we went about doing this. And then, what is one thing most people don't know about you?
Well, most people don't know everything about me, I think. that's a good question. I have a pretty like prototypical like Philly white guy suburbs trajectory. Like I'm 100% Irish, grew up Catholic. My family is from like on both sides of my family from like a 5-block radius in the western part of South Philadelphia in St. Monica's Parish. But I grew up in the suburbs and went to Northwestern, and then now I'm at the Enquirer, where a lot of people are like not from here, or at least people my age. So I think my sources or people I meet on the job are surprised to hear the family connections or the fact that I personally know someone who's worked with them or went to school with them. So I think the most surprising thing, which is an interesting comment on journalism these days being so transplant focused, is that, you know, it's surprising to my sources and stuff to hear that I am from the area as thoroughly as I am.
Yeah. No, and that, you know, honestly, there were two questions I forgot to ask you at the end of the biography section. One was, I talk to so many foreign correspondents who like are covering not even the same country they're from. And you are the complete opposite, covering, you know, the place you are from, like, and you must know it so well. And yeah, have like people you went to school with who are just like around in this kind of network that actually I know very few journalists have that goes back that far. What is that like? And I mean, I imagine you've been there now this 5 years, you're from there. I mean, at some point, like, can you just be like, hey, I'm from here, like, you can trust me? And does that help? So yeah, I guess that's a double-barreled question. What's it like if there's any more to it than just people being surprised by the connections? And yeah, does it get you any further in your reporting?
I think it depends on a couple of things. I think it does get me further with, you know, a certain group of people who are just like me, right? From like kind of white guy, Catholic Philly or whatever, you know, and there are two current chiefs of staff on Philadelphia City Council who overlapped with me in high school at Holy Ghost, which is pretty hilarious.
Oh, wow.
And, you know, those people I personally know, so that can help. I mean, I wasn't like tight with them in high school, but like I know who they are. But then it's more like a random political consultant in Philly will be like, you know, oh, my daughter's going to Nazareth. And I'll be like, oh, I went to Holy Ghost, which is the sister-brother school, you know, relationship with Nazareth. And they'll be like, oh, great, you know, and then I can tell that that kind of warms them up to me. But I have to note, and it's really fascinating and something the Enquirer is trying to do better, is that, you know, I think the Enquirer is very much seen as a white institution in Philadelphia. And knowing that my family, like, you know, we're very much white flight folks, you know, who moved to the suburbs, you know, because, quote, the neighborhood went bad, you know, which is not a politics I agree with. But that is my upbringing, you know. So I think, like, black politicians, in many cases, definitely not all cases, that wouldn't help. They'd be like, oh, I know your type. I know your perspective. And so then I have to communicate, like, I want to see things from where you're coming from. So it is like people can assume a lot about me. A lot of it is true, and sometimes it helps and sometimes it might not.
That makes sense. Yeah. And yeah, I mean, how much does, in terms of knowledge, like having grown up in the area, helped? Because I'm trying to think back, like how much I paid attention to some of this stuff, if that would be useful at all. I mean, you know, do you know any of the history of city politics and things like that? Or was that pretty on the periphery for you growing up?
It was on the periphery, but I just, as growing up in the area, like the John Street, Sam Katz, mayor's races, there were two back to back, were like huge deals. And I do remember like the bug being found in the mayor's office and John Street's administration. And so I do have kind of these like, you know, where were you on 9/11 moments. I would say what's more helpful than that is that like having a more intimate knowledge of the city is super helpful in a place like Philadelphia, because the political sort of factions and tribes are very geographical, and you can memorize all the politicians from each faction, but you got to get to know those neighborhoods, or you have to have a sort of more native sense of why the Northwest African-American politicians might not be on the same page with the West Philadelphia politicians, you know, and why those are separate families. And so I think it is helpful just to have a life of like thinking about Philadelphia and how that maps onto political alliances. That being said, you know, like my City Hall bureau mate, Anna Orso, she's from York, Pennsylvania, which I know is also nearby, but it's like, you know, it's not Philly. And you can learn this, and she's like phenomenal. And she totally gets all the ins and outs. She covered public safety before coming to City Hall. So she's seen the city, you know, at crime scenes and just, you know, in life inside and out. So it's, I'm not saying you can't learn it, but that is where it helps, I think, is to have like an innate sense of an area of the city.
Gotcha. And I guess I'll ask the other question now, even though I might edit these and put them at the end of the biography section, because I'll see where it fits better. But the other question is where things are headed for you. I mean, you're in your hometown, more or less, and you're somebody who had this vision of being a foreign correspondent. You know, you spent some time in Uganda. I could see it both ways. I'm at an age where I'm not, like, I was trying so hard for so much of my life to, like, get out and, like, make a name for myself and things like that and be a foreign correspondent. But now I kind of see the appeal if I could just be working in my, you know, where I'm from, like, which is actually most journalists, like, you don't actually get a lot of choice. You need to, like, you can work your way towards something, but most of us just go, you know, where the best job we can find is, especially graduating in the financial crisis. So I guess I'm just curious if you see yourself in Philadelphia, you know, 5-10 years from now, or if you're already angling for a move, or, and as much as you can say without pissing off your employer, I guess.
I was going to say that's a tough question, but luckily I'm not angling to move now, but I would otherwise have to lie now. The Enquirer is owned by the Lenfest Institute, so it's a for-profit that's owned by this nonprofit endowment. So I'm hopeful, like very hopeful, both for my sake and more importantly for Philly, that means it has a more sustainable future than, you know, especially the cities there whose papers are getting bought up by private equity and things like that. So, you know, fingers crossed that, you know, I'm not someone who needs to end up at the Times or the Post. I would be happy working there, you know, but I love Philly, my family's here. And so if that worked out, that'd be great. That being said, if it looks like this nonprofit experiment doesn't work in Philly, I'll probably try to look to New York or DC to go there. It is a priority for me to like stay in driving distance of my family. I got nieces and nephews and all that. So the East Coast is appealing, but yeah, I'm flexible beyond that.
Sure, sure. And yeah, I mean, stability is rare these days. So yeah, if they have a stable situation set up, I mean, even, you know, you look at the LA Times, it was bought by what seemingly benevolent private actor, you know, one dude. At least it's not private equity, and they're also laying a ton of people off at the moment, last time I checked. So, I mean, there's something to be said for that, for sure. And it's very rare at this point in newspaper journalism. So, yeah, I hope that goes well with their nonprofit experiment. The next one is, what is your most embarrassing journalism-related story?
When I was at the Philadelphia Daily News, they ran a story that I was not a part of on the cover after, I forget what it was, but it basically a bunch of folks in the police department got either accused or convicted of, you know, criminal wrongdoing, corruption. And we ran a Photoshop thing of the Roundhouse, which is the police headquarters, or was the police headquarters in Philadelphia. And it had like caution tape all over it. And it was like crime scene under investigation. You know, that was the headline. So the mayor was pissed, obviously, big defender of the cops. Police department was pissed. And I'm like 23 and I roll into an unrelated press conference that I have to cover. And I haven't read the paper that morning and I'm running a little late. And the mayor just like sees me, walks in and like sits down. And I'm just like trying to get my bearings, does whatever the press conference was. I forget what it was. It was a nothing burger. And then one TV reporter like asks a question about our story in the paper that I was not a part of. And was up to that point not aware of. And the mayor just like turns to me and is just like yelling at me about the Daily News, and he's like, well, if we had a real newspaper in this town, then they would. And I'm which is like fine, I've been yelled at by elected officials, but it was like mortifying because I was like, I don't even know what we're talking about right now, and this room of like 100 people are looking at this 23-year-old idiot. So the lesson is to make sure you read the paper before you go to work.
Yeah, wow. And yeah, no, I prefer to be the reason the official is yelling at me if I'm going to be yelled at. And I actually kind of like that. Like if I've really pissed somebody off that much, it's a good sign. But yeah, not for a story you didn't write.
Oh yeah, I like that. And people have different styles of that, right? Some people are like going to yell back at you and like be like, that's why we're journalists, you know, but then maybe you're this way. I like to do the like, oh, I will take your thoughts into consideration, but do you have any factual corrections you would like me to pass along to my editor? You know, to just kind of smile through it. But that's always enjoyable, yeah, when they're on you for a good piece of journalism that you did.
Yeah, yeah. No, one of my best memories is the environment minister telling me to my face, like, your story was lamentable, like, in Portuguese. And I, you know, I just kind of smirk and just nod, like, yeah, yeah.
Lamentable, nice. Yeah,
lamentable.
I won't attempt that.
He was a, you know. Anyway, I won't get into it.
Feel free.
He's one of those guys who is kind of like this villain type character, but like, man, did I have some of the most fun in my entire career chasing this dude around because of that.
Yeah.
Let's see. And now he's a congressman.
Oh, there you go.
The next one is kind of a pinch me, I can't believe it's my life moment. Have you ever had either the coolest, strangest, most surreal in a positive or negative way that your job, a situation your job has taken you into that you just are like, I can't believe this is my job, that I'm here and this is happening or I'm doing this?
I think so. I think maybe folks can relate that there's sort of a trained desensitizing to that feeling, like as your career goes on, right? You're not supposed to be super excited about this. You're the neutral observer, right? So the time I've definitely felt it most intensely was in college before I started trying to be a cool guy and not feel like that or talk about that, you know? So Obama was elected in 08 and we covered it for the Daily and we had like press passes and we went down to Grant Park and all that. And we just like covered what felt like a really momentous moment in history. And I was walking over the bridge, like from the Loop to near North or, you know, Michigan Avenue or whatever it was, to like escape the throngs at the end of it. And I remember just like stopping on the bridge and looking at the river and being like, wow, this is like the first time where I feel like I am at the center of like the news universe. Like if someone's paying attention to something outside of where they are at, it's probably Grant Park, you know, it's probably right here. And so that was the first time I had that sensation.
Yeah, no, that's a memorable moment for me too, although a bit different. I was the opinion page editor, and I remember like Noman Merchant, the managing editor, and Libby were like, you've got to write one editorial for if Obama wins and one for if McCain wins. And I'm like, come on, Obama's going to win. I'm not writing both of these. And so like took the gamble and like was just waiting. And when the election was called, filed that. And immediately as quick as I could got to the Metra and took the Metra down to Grant Park and like rendezvoused with some friends. And we were definitely drinking on the Metra and then trampled some like vegetable garden within Grant Park while like trying to find a spot to watch the speech.
Oh no.
Like standing in like a shrub or something like that.
Yeah.
But yeah, it was a notable moment. And yeah, in the end I was right and I didn't have to write that second editorial.
There you go.
Cool. And then the last two questions, what is your favorite film, book, TV, or other media property about journalists and why?
I'm going to say The Paper, the 1994 movie directed by Ron Howard starring Michael Keaton. And the reason is because it, and I'm definitely not the first person to say this, this has, you know, been tweeted and written about, but it has, I think, the most accurate depiction of the vibe in the newsroom. Just like the quirky characters and the mountains of paper on some reporter's desk and the way you can yell at each other and it's fine, which I think sadly is like a culture that's really dying.
Yeah.
At a lot of newspapers. But I feel like I got the last glimpse of that in the beginning of my career, and it was really nice. And I feel like I learned a lot from those folks and being in that environment. And I feel like the paper captured it well. Also, they have this really funny moment in it where, you know, they need to stop the presses at some point, and they sort of like acknowledge it. There's like this meta movie making line, right, where they like Michael Keaton and I forget who like turn to each other and they're like, "Are you going to say it or am I going to say it? Are we actually doing this? Stop the presses!" You know. So I feel like they acknowledged you know that what they were doing with that. So I liked that too.
Cool. Yeah. No, I've not seen the paper. I feel like somebody might have shouted out before, but I need to go back and watch it because, yeah, in retrospect, I wish I had relished more of my time in like Myrtle Beach. Like, I enjoyed it, but it was so much of like, I just need to get the hell out of here. Like, this job is not going anywhere. Like, not going to get me anywhere good fast. So, but it's a cool vibe when there's a busy newsroom.
Yeah, and you got that copy editor who hasn't, like, smiled in 25 years and, you know, just kind of, like, slaps your story back on your desk and, you know, all the different characters in the newsroom, I feel like, aren't around anymore.
Yeah, yeah. The guy who smokes so much he cannot edit your story all in one go without going out to have a cigarette. So he prints it off and he is marking it up with pencil and you're like, this is kind of old school. yeah, those kind of moments. Okay, and then the last question is, qualifications aside, if you couldn't be a journalist, what job would you do?
I think what job I would most likely do is lawyer. But I think what I would want to do is campaigns, and this is probably not going to be true in my future chapters in life, but you know, I think I did a lot of my reporting that I'm most proud of has been on campaigns, and I feel like I understand the campaign world and liked moving around a lot when I was younger. And just so I feel like, you know, being a full-time campaign consultant, do that seasonal thing where you're, you know, you get paid a good amount during the campaign and then you're sort of floundering and then the next campaign season comes along. So I probably would have been most interested in that in my 20s and early 30s, I think.
Yeah, no, I hear that. I mean, in another life, I might have done that too. My parents were big in Democratic Party politics, and so I spent a lot of time around that as a kid. Like, my mom was the state chair and stuff, so, like, you know, whatever, they'd be working on whatever state senate campaign or this or that. And
Yeah,
it's an interesting life, for sure. Okay.
Yeah.
Cool. But it sounds like, I mean, are you still a journalism diehard in the sense that it sounds like you've thought if things go really bad here, I'll drive to another city like New York or DC or something and just try to figure that out first?
Yeah, that would definitely be my first choice. You mean like before going to the dark side or whatever?
Yeah.
Yeah, I think I'm less gung-ho about that than, you know, I certainly was in, you know, my mid-20s or whatever, but, and I totally get now why people make changes, and I wouldn't be surprised at all if that happened to me, you know, especially if, who knows what's going to happen in the next recession to, you know, our industry. So my first instinct would certainly be to try to keep it going, but I'm less dogmatic now about how this is the only good industry or whatever.
Yeah, never say never, and It was so much about just trying to get our foot in the door and trying to get to a place that was like livable and stuff I know it can get bad and tough and so never say never. But I always thought like I could pick out like the people who are actually going to stick with it from college, like whether you or Nilman or various people and even some people who got out and have come back in. I guess Danny Yadrin's the only time I've gotten it really wrong. I don't know where he went wrong, man.
I got that one wrong, too.
Yeah.
Don't beat yourself up.
Anyway, some inside baseball. So I guess, you know, that's all my questions. I'll wrap up at least the recorded part by saying thanks so much for coming on the podcast, Sean.
Thanks for having me. This is a really nice thing you do, so I appreciate being on.
That's our show. Thanks for listening to my conversation with Sean Collins Walsh, a City Hall reporter at the Philadelphia Inquirer. I'll post links to some of the things Sean talked about in the podcast description and also on our show page, foreignpod.podbean.com. If you like this episode of Foreign Correspondence, please subscribe to it in Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Spotify, YouTube, or wherever you get your podcasts, and give it a rating. Beyond that, it would be a huge help if you also write out a review saying what you think about the show. It helps get the podcast more attention. Follow or tweet at me on X at foreignpod, on Facebook, our page is facebook.com/foreignpod. Above all, if you know someone who might like the podcast, please recommend it to them. The show is produced and edited by me. Our music is a track called Love Chances by Makai Beats. There's more information on that in the podcast description and on our show page. Please look out for my next episode to drop in June. Until then, I'm Jake Spring, and this is Foreign Correspondence.